Unified with Momobo Ogoro. This is News Talk.
Welcome to another episode of Unified. This is a show where we listen, learn, laugh to ultimately unify across our differences. Now, Father's Day is a meaningful day for most fathers in Ireland and globally. But did you know that some people's paths to fatherhood can be much more difficult than others? I'm going to be talking to a man who has overcome systemic barriers and prejudices and multiple rejections in building his family as a gay single man. Welcome Vincent Ryan, who's going to be sharing his story and proud journey to becoming a father of two. Welcome Vincent, how are you?
I'm really well. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Delighted to have you on. So, chatting about fatherhood and your experience, I just want to know, like, at what point in your life did you say, hey, I want to become a father?
It's a really interesting point. So growing up in Ireland as a closeted gay guy, I guess, way back when, I just came to terms with the fact that I'd never be a dad. And it was something I'd always wanted to be. I think Ireland is so family orientated. And I think with the movement that kind of happened with our LGBTQ rights and the legalization of like marriage and becoming parents, I started to explore the possibility of adoption. The only complexity with me was the fact that I was a single gay guy looking to adopt a child, and the way I did it had never been done before. So I had to kind of overcome some pretty big barriers just to get to the point where I welcomed my eldest son when he was 10 weeks old. And then I gave it a couple of years and I decided I wanted to add to the family again, remained single. And that's when I then adopted a 4-day-old little boy as well, just to add to the mix.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And specifically, that journey of doing it on your own, what kind of struck you to make that decision?
Oh my God. Well, there was a lot of wine involved in getting me through some of the really harsher bits of reality of becoming a parent, for sure. But I don't know, like, I've never let anything stand in my way, really. And I think when you have one chance at life, you kind of have to just think, do you know what, I'm going to go for it, I'm going to give it my all and see what happens. So I'm one of those where I don't really believe in the word can't. So when someone says you can't do something, I tend to work extra hard to find a way around it, just to show that anything is possible with the right belief.
That's beautiful. And it's something of that resilience and that sort of ambition is the thing that has brought you to being a father of two. And I suppose you said there's many sort of challenges and obstacles in your way. Can you kind of walk us through the adoption process, especially as a single parent?
Yeah, no, of course. So automatically your support network is pretty much halved, because as one part of a couple, you've got someone to rely on and you've got somebody that can step in when times get hard. So automatically you're kind of meeting your first fence there, because you are going ahead on your own. And there will be times where, you know, it is quite tough having children full stop, regardless of the background they have come from. So there's a little bit more of procedural processes put in place for single people, just to make sure you've got that good support network around you. You have a tried and tested support network that can step in and help when times get tough. So automatically, I kind of face challenges. And the way in which I adopted had never been done before. So not only was I facing the prejudice of not being in a couple, not being female, not being straight. So they really did, I think, at the time, take a massive risk in kind of taking me as far as they did and just seeing how that would play out and how it would pay off. And thankfully for me, I've been really successful in making it work, and I've paved the way for other people coming up behind me that want a family and aren't always in a relationship to kind of make that dream happen.
And it's so important to kind of be that person that changes the idea, the system, the preconceptions around what a family looks like, around what adoption looks like, especially as a single gay man. So I just commend you. And now tell us about the kids, the boys. I'd love to hear more about them.
Oh my God. So let me tell you, two boys, for anyone listening, two boys are, it's hard work. My eldest is approaching nine, and my youngest now is approaching five. And they have a love-hate relationship, I think, like any siblings.
Any
I mean,
sibling
I grew up
relationship,
in
yeah.
100%. So I spend most of my days negotiating for world peace, and I truly believe that I could step into any situation now and solve a world war. If I'm not negotiating for one of them to let go of the other one's hair or to give up a toy to share. So life is busy, and then I work full time as well. So it's an incredible journey. It's definitely one of the hardest jobs I have ever done in my life, but it is one of the most rewarding things. I mean, they're incredible young men, and also I've taken them into a situation which is quite unique. You know, they're of a school age now, and they've got friends with mummies and daddies, and already kind of raising the next generation for them to kind of fight for their path to be accepted in a family that is uniquely different to anyone else. So it's definitely incredible having them, but it is hard work for sure.
And I can imagine it must be very hard. And like beyond world peace, how do you have the conversation with them if they, if it, I don't know, but if at any point they've come to you asking about your family structure, have you had that conversation, or how did, or do you have that conversation with the kids?
Yeah, so I've always been open and honest throughout, and I've always answered any questions, especially with my eldest Alfie. I've always answered questions directly to him. But I think the beautiful thing about children is they are so accepting of everything and anyone. They don't see color, they don't see race, they don't see a different dynamic. They literally just see what's in front of them. So it's beautiful, really, because you almost get like, it's almost like a fresh pot of plasticine that you can kind of mold into what you want them and how you want them to see the world. So they don't come with a preconceived idea of what's normal, and I don't like that word, but of what's normal. So you're teaching them actually, and it's beautiful to see now because they don't even bat an eyelid. I mean, they don't reference to not having another parent or not having a mom or another dad. They just kind of get on with daily life, and they answer questions beautifully whenever they get asked. You know, they always say, no, we don't have a mommy, we've just got daddy. And just watching them actually grow and being able to answer those questions is fulfilling in itself, because I know then I'm doing a good job.
And that's a huge source of pride. And I know you've kind of mentioned some of the challenges, but I want to ask, are there any sort of joys in embarking on this journey on your own?
There is, I mean, there have been pushback, and I think I document my journey online, and I do get some vile abuse online, and you do get some awful pushback online. But I always think, do you know what? For somebody to be that upset by something, then they have an automatic interest in it. And I think in a world that we live in at the minute, people don't like to always see people succeed. So for me, if I'm annoying somebody that much through having a really happy and content family and two boys that are thriving, then it means I'm doing something right. Because for them to be upset by that, I have to, you know, be rubbing them up the wrong way in how I'm doing things. So day by day, it's constant to just prove that what I have and what I've worked and fought for should be as accepted as, you know, mum and dad that live next door with 2.4 children.
And that's a great way to approach life. Kill them with kindness and just live your
A hundred
life.
percent.
Be joyful, be happy. The kids are thriving, you're happy. A beautiful way to approach the haters online. And as we're discussing, Father's Day is coming up. Do you have anything special that you're going to do for the day?
You know, it's really bizarre. So the only downfall sometimes to being on your own, but you've got nobody to kind of pre-plan anything. And that's the one thing that I've had to get used to. So I'm very used to bits of paper with dried pasta stuck on it. And I'm very used to drawings that look very dodgy in their theme sometimes. But actually, my Father's Day is just watching them get up, be happy, be joyful. We dance in the kitchen every single morning without fail. That's how we start the day, with a dance and a positive song. And just watching them smile, laugh, be content, be popular, and just engaging, that's present enough for me. So the day will be spent as it always is, me getting up, getting their breakfast, getting everything done. And we'll just then do as we do, we'll walk the dog. we'll probably go out for dinner and just kind of have the day together. And it's a chance for me to actually sit back and think. It's a real pinch me moment because never, ever in my life, growing up in a tiny town down in Kilkenny, back in the 80s, early 90s, did I ever dream that anybody would call me dad or daddy. So that in itself is reward enough for me.
And that is a dream come true. And I'm sure there are many people in your circumstance are even thinking that this is a dream that could never be a reality for them. So I want to ask you, Vincent, like, if for anybody that's listening who may be queer, LGBTQ plus, that is facing hurdles on their path to parenthood, what would your advice be to them?
I would say that as long as you know within your heart and soul that what you want is definitely what you want out of your life, and I don't mitigate away from the fact it is incredibly hard and you do set yourself up for prejudice and you automatically set yourself up for abuse. But I've always said to anyone the exact same as I say to my boys, you get one shot at life, just that one go. And I always think when my time comes, I don't want to lay there and regret what I haven't done. I'd rather sometimes think about what I have done. So follow your dream, and there will be many people that will try and tear you down. There'll be many people that will try and talk you out of it. But actually, just by being yourself, your true self, your true identity, then already you've overcome a massive hurdle. So anything after that should be a walk in the park. But just follow your hope, follow your dream, and surround yourself with people that will lift you up, encourage you, and drive you forward. And just try and stay away from those that try to have you on their path instead of the unique one that you're on yourself.
Thank you so much, Vincent. That was really inspirational. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. And it's been lovely to chat. Thank you so much.
Brilliant. And now we're also being joined by Seamus Carney-Martone, a husband and father of two, to share his story on growing up gay in rural Roscommon to building a relationship and a family that he hoped for. Welcome, Seamus.
Hi, Momo. Well, thank you for having me.
Seamus, can you tell us your story in becoming a father?
Sure. So as you mentioned there, I grew up in rural Ireland in County Roscommon. And I moved to Dublin then for college, and I've been here since. I met my now husband when I was 19, and we've been together for almost 20 years now. And we had a civil partnership in 2014, and then we got married after the marriage equality referendum in 2016. And I guess we always knew that it was nearly unspoken that we would like to have a family. We never actually sat down and discussed it per se, but we always kind of just knew that was something that we would like to look into. Then we started looking into the options for same-sex male couples. You know, what pathways to parenthood are there for us? So at the time, we met with a surrogacy solicitor, Fiona Duffy, who kind of guided us through what the process would be if we went down the surrogacy route. And we also attended a TUSLA information morning about intercountry adoption. Because we were I was in my mid-20s at the time, we decided that we probably had a little bit of time. So we thought that the best route for us at that point in time was to go down the adoption route. So we signed up, I guess, through TUSLA. We ran through the various stages of that. So you have your initial assessment, then you have a group study session, and then you're assessed by a social worker. And then over the space of, I'll say, 18 months, we went through this assessment process, and ultimately we were deemed eligible and suitable to adopt a child from the US by the Adoption Authority of Ireland. So that was a huge milestone for us. But I guess what that meant then for us is that we were put onto a wait list, or they call it a match list, in the US. So we were waiting to be matched with a baby from the US. So that was around 2019. And then, of course, as we all know, in 2020, COVID took over and everything shut down for a period of time. Interestingly enough, though, through that lockdown period, we were matched with a birth mom who was at the time 6 months pregnant with a boy. We decided to proceed with that match. as I said, she was 6 months pregnant. We met with her several times via Zoom, and that baby was born in September 2020. And just as we were kind of preparing to travel to the US, we got the, I guess, unfortunate news for us that the birth mom had made the brave decision to parent her son herself.
How did that feel?
Awful. It's the probably the darkest moment that I've ever had in my life, for sure. It was very, very difficult. Just because we had kind of prepared our home, we had prepared our family, we had told everyone foolishly, and you know, you're kind of advised not to do that, but at the time you're just so excited, and you know, it was really the untelling of people that, you know, it hasn't happened was kind of the hardest part. So yeah, we took a bit of time after that to do a bit of reflection on the process, and you know, ultimately we decided, because we were on the match list in the US, to continue with staying on it. And a year and a day after that baby boy was born, we actually got a phone call. We were in Majorca on a holiday. It was the first holiday that we had kind of post all of the lockdowns. And we were just sitting around the pool, and we got a phone call. I got a phone call from the Irish intermediary agency. They're called Helping Hands. They're based in Cork. And oftentimes you would get a phone call just to, you know, get additional paperwork, or, you know, you'd have to get your Garda clearance and all that updated annually. So I just thought, you know, it's probably just one of those phone calls. But she said to the social worker at the time, said to me, "Are you sitting down?" I said, "I was." And she told me that a baby girl had been born. The birth mother had already signed the consent, meaning that she had kind of got approved to go ahead with the adoption.
Wow, and how did that feel at the moment?
That was absolutely crazy. It was crazy for many reasons, mm-hmm. because number one, we weren't at home. We were in like a completely different setting. Number two, we had said that, you know, if any new match had happened, we wouldn't tell anybody, just for self-preservation, I suppose, having gone through the failed adoption the year prior. But I just so happened to be sitting around the table with my in-laws, so my parents-in-law, my sister-in-law. So we basically had to tell them immediately. So it was just very intense. And then obviously we decided that we'd proceed with the match. We were still kind of in a situation where it was sort of COVID lockdown. So we had to try and get back to Dublin as quickly as possible. And then you needed additional visa waivers to travel to the US at that time. So we got working on that. But yeah, we met our daughter in the US when she was 17 days old.
That is such a beautiful story. Thank you so much for sharing. And it sounds like you've had such a, from my perspective, an emotional roller coaster in your realization to becoming, you and your husband's realization into becoming parents. And just as you're sharing it, in a final word, what would be your advice to anybody that is going through that turbulent time?
I guess persevere with the process. You know, adoption is not for the faint-hearted. It can be, I describe it as quite invasive. You know, your whole life is put out there in front of an assessing social worker, and ultimately they make a determination on whether you're suitable to adopt or not. And then obviously, as I mentioned, there are, you know, other things, like other factors that can happen to contribute to making the process that little bit harder. And I guess that was for that reason. For our second child, for our son, Mateo, we actually decided to go down the surrogacy route, just having been kind of a bit burned by the adoption process. We thought that it would be probably more sensible, or just a different pathway, I guess, to becoming a parent a second time by going down the surrogacy route.
Well, thank you so much, Seamus, for sharing your story. And it sounds that like this journey has been one that has been emotional, but well forth fulfilling, because you now have your beautiful family of four with Mateo and Maisie. Thank you again for coming on the show. And listeners, let us know if you're a dad and how are you celebrating Father's Day. You can let us know on unified@newstalk.com. That's unified with a Y-O-U. Now, on this week's What's Your Story, we're joined by comedian Iman Idama, whose unique perspective on culture, life and identity has shaped how he tells funny stories. From Dublin and born in Nigeria, Iman uses humour to explore experiences that connect us and sometimes the hilarious realities of living across multiple cultures. Welcome, Iman. How are you?
Fun to be here.
Delighted. So can you kind of tell us your story of how you came into the world of comedy?
Okay, so I'm born in Nigeria. And I came here at the age of 8 or 9. I don't know exactly. It's been too long. And like from a young age, right? I love comedy. I used to like just watch it on the PC at home. You know, the big PCs to go and like after home, just in there watching like a bunch of stand-up from like the States. Like Dave Chappelle, the Kevin Hart back in the days, like American like stand-up. You get me? And then I was watching it, but in my head, right? And like one thing I said to myself was, how can somebody get into stand-up? Because I was like, how do you get into it? Because I just saw it on TV, I saw it on YouTube, I type in stuff. I'm like, yeah, but how, like, as was the process. And then one day, Fabidi then said to me, Iman, I'm doing a big show and in the Laughter Lounge, right? And I need you to do just 5 minutes. I was like, I'll do 5 minutes. And I said to my friend, like Sean, I was like, Sean, come on, let's do it together. I was like, yeah, because like back then, right, and the two of us we were the funny guys only in our group. The two of us were just like the funniest people in our group. So it was like, let's do it. And then everybody was texting me, Iman, where are you? I was like, I'm home. She's like, come down. I was like, boys, I'm broke. They're like, Iman. I was like, listen, because at that time, right, I was panicking. I was like, oh my God, I am going to be so bad. And I said to him, Iman, come down. We will pay for your taxi. I was like, damn, okay.
That's good friends.
To attack No, they're not good friends. They're just going to see all my downfall. Like, they were like, Iman is going, let's, boys are boys. We're like, we'll see him downfall, right? So, man, I was like, okay, cool. Let's come down, right? Then I came, down to the Laughs Lounge, right? And I saw everybody was there. It was sold out. Then they said to me, Iman, you're next. I was like, really? And then it brought me up. And then I said, hey, I'm Nigerian. Oh, my goodness. Like, the store is so warm. It's so heat. I did some, like, cheesy jokes. And, like, literally, like, a bunch of people laughed. And I was like, oh, I actually like this. I got into it.
And I think it's that's kind of these stories of just, like, coming up kind of gets you into, of just doing, you're feeling scared, but you just do it anyway.
You
just do it anyway and get into it. And I'd love to know, like, how did you, just even for myself, coming from a Nigerian background, how did you tell your parents you want to get into comedy?
I didn't tell my parents because you would never do that to a black Nigerian parents. That is failure at its maximum. You have failed me in every way of life. Yeah, I didn't tell my mom. I was just like, hey, mom, I'm going out with my friends every night. Yeah. And then she's like, hey, man, tell me, are you selling drugs? I was like, no. I'm not just like, are you sure? I was like, no. Like, I don't smoke and I barely drink. I don't do just like, but why are you out all the time at night? I was like, because I do like singing in where? I was like, in the church, I'm drumming and practicing. Like, oh, okay. And I lied. I told her, I'm in church, I practice. She's like, okay, go. Yeah, go. Like, you want me to drop you? No, don't drop me. I'll find my way. Okay, don't come see me in the pub.
And does she know until now?
Now she does.
And how did she take it? Like,
she is still
you're telling
like,
jokes.
Okay. And it's weird because if she sees me do like TV stuff and in the UK, like she's very, but yeah, oh, you've been doing, then now she's like, Iman, why the hell are you not in like TV stuff in Ireland? I was just like, the UK has like more opportunities and stuff like that because I didn't want to tell her like the real reason.
Mm.
Why?
What's the real reason?
The real reason is in Ireland, if you are, okay, I don't want to play like the race card, but if like you are like dark color, it's like 10 times and so much harder to feature festivals or like stuff like that. It's so hard. And like I've done some more stuff and in the UK in like TV in festival wise, like much bigger stuff. But and yeah, not a sniff.
Mm, that must be hard.
It is hard. It is very difficult. But there's nothing I can do because I've done everything that I've tried to do. Right, I've sent emails. I've like, hey, hey, I've done this TV stuff, I've gigged with this email, and I get nothing back. And I'm just like, what else do I got to do? So I'm doing stand-up for maybe 14 years now. If I see more young black people in the scene, and I always tell them, it's very hard in Ireland. Okay, to just get here and just practice and then move to the UK. Because in Ireland, yeah, they always say, like, diversity in comedy, right? And like, that means male, female, LGBT. That's basically it. Like, in the comedy world, like, in this country, they say, like, diversity, it's male, female, LGBT. Now, like, I'm a male. So they're like, yeah, that's male covered. We're going to get a female. We're going to get the LGBT. So, like, it's weird because there's a comedian. He's from Nigeria as well. He works hard. And I remember the first time I saw him, and he spoke to me, Iman, and please give me your advice. And I said to him, kid, it's hard. I haven't done this. And he was like, Iman, come on, stop being bitter. I'm like, I'm not bitter. I'm just telling you, it's 10 times as hard. Like, oh, Iman, nah, you stop being like that. You're being like that. Like, okay, cool. Then last year, so he then called me, right? And said, Iman, I'm so sorry, you're right.
Mm.
I was like, well, it's like, you're right about everything you said. There's no look. I've done everything. And like, he gigs everywhere. Like, he goes to the open mics. He does all the stuff that I did. Him time I was coming up. Like, he was doing gigs everywhere in Ireland, the countryside, doing gigs to a small room of 10 people just to get the practicing to be better. You got to get the practicing. And then it comes to the day, it was like, why have I not done this? I was like, it's just, you got to go to the UK. Like, you have to move.
It's really hard to hear that because, like, you would think that in terms of just Ireland in general, like, the arts, because comedy is a part of an art. It's open, it's welcoming. And I've even actually been to one of your sets before. Obviously, you're a comedian. I was going to say you're very funny.
Yeah, thank you.
But, like, the way you're actually able to hold a room, the way you're able to just flow with the room, how does it feel to just be in that space and just, it just comes to you off the top?
Literally, right? That was me off stage. But that's me, on stage and off stage. The way my friends, I'm just, like, the exact same, like, posting. Very cheeky, very quick, very, like, on the ball, like, very like, you give me some, I throw it back at you quickly. So basically, right, so me doing stand-up was so easy. You get me? Now, if it comes to doing the stuff you do, like, you have to read, I have dyslexia for days, which I'll be in that book looking at it for like, all I can tell you is and there. Good luck with the rest. You get me? So for me, it's some that is like a love, it's passion. And when it comes to stand-up, I like so much love just to watch it and do it as well. You get me? A little like do you know some, you'll be like, oh my God, I love it, but like, I can't watch it. I mean, like, I love to watch it. I love to do it. Like, I love to go home and just get like my laptop and I like, just put like a bunch of stand up on. And my girlfriend's like, Iman, we're not watching stand up again. You just came from a comedy. This is like, can we stop? Like, do you stop? I was like, okay, come on, let's watch something. Let's watch a movie. I'm just on my phone. Like, she's like, get off your phone and stop watching stand up. I'm like, okay, sorry. Like,
it's a passion.
Get it.
It's a passion. And like, where can people see your work or my engage
work
with you?
Yes, you can see my work at In Stitches Comedy. We run shows there 7 nights a week. That is the club I MC at that I started because I was trying to create like a space for everybody to come and perform. Everybody, because like in the scene, as I said to you, like it's all tightness. As in, if you do a gig, they have to go out and drink. Me, I don't really drink. You get me? If I finish, I go home. I just chill at home. But like, so like, if you go to In Stitches Comedy on Dame Street on Panakani's The Basement, 7 nights a week. Also, you find me on Instagram and YouTube, other stuff at Black Irish Comic. And I've gotten a lot of trouble because of that name for some people that was like, you're not Irish. I was like, it's just a handle.
It's just an ad to find me there.
Yeah, like, we will not get on this semantics on handle. Like, it's easy for people to find me. Like, no one can spell, like, my last name, like, Idama. They're like, how do you spell it? Like, so Black Irish comic, very easy to know and find.
You tell that to them. I'm making it easier for you.
I know. I'm like, please, if you find me and say some stuff to me, you know?
Awesome, awesome. Well, thank you so much, Iman. I know how difficult it can be in these industries, in the creative industries
it is.
Specifically. Oh. But thank you so much for sharing your story, your art with us. And folks, again, you can join Iman in the comedy show in Stitches and Dame Street 7 nights a week, or you can find him at Black Irish Comic on Instagram. Up next on The Social Scene, we'll be discussing with Captain Day Centre on ways on how we can support those experiencing homelessness. Welcome back to Unified with me, Mamoba Ogoro. Now, for almost 60 years, the Capuchin Day Centre in Dublin has been the lifeline for people experiencing homelessness, poverty and hardship, offering not just meals, but practical supports, dignity, respect and hope in a time of their life that is extremely difficult. So joining me today is Father Kevin Kiernan, Director of Capuchin Day Centre, to discuss the growing need for vital services and the humanity around these experiences and how we can support people living in homelessness. Welcome, Father Kevin.
Thank you.
So, Father, can you tell us the origin story of Capuchin Day Centre and how it evolved to what it's doing today?
Okay. So as Capuchins, we're a member of the Franciscan family. So central to our calling is to reach out to the poor and the marginalised. So in all our communities over the years, we always had what was known as St. Anthony's Poor Box. And we used that collection to feed the poor who came to our friaries. Now in the 60s, Brother Kevin was stationed in Church Street in Dublin, and he noticed the queues coming to the friary became longer and longer. I suppose the straw that broke the camel's back was one day he was walking down the street and he met a young man who was rooting in a bin looking for food to feed his family. So Kevin said, no, we need to do something about this. So Kevin, being Kevin, the good Cork man he is and full of the spirit of St. Francis, he started a soup kitchen in Church Street to feed homeless men with soup and sandwiches. And initially that fed about 60 people a day. Of course, we all know that it's not only men that are homeless and hungry, it's people in general. So that grew from a small kind of a hut in Church Street to what it is today. And the unfortunate thing is, I suppose Kevin, he said, no, we'll deal with this problem and then we'll move on and we'll deal with some other problem. We look at the society in general as friars and we try to identify needs and then to respond to that need. So Kevin said this will be grand in a few years. But obviously we know now we feed over 1,000 people a day.
Wow.
6 days a week in our centre in Church Street.
And like you've just talked about the growing demand of your work and your services. And when it comes to the reality of like homelessness in Dublin, and like you said, it's not just men, why do you believe the demand has continued to grow for your services?
I think there's lots of factors like over the years. And like if you go back to the 80s, there was we had the recession and that kind of sprung people into homelessness. Now we have the problem in the Gulf and the fuel prices are going up and that has a knock-on effect to people buying food or whatever it may be. Then the housing crisis, people can't afford houses, they can't afford to get on the property ladder, whatever it might be. So there's a combination of different things. I suppose like we will come across people who are actually employed but they can't afford to buy their food. We had last winter, people had to make a decision. Will I spend my money on heating my house or will I spend my money on feeding myself? So it's very difficult for people. And I see old age pensioners who have spent their whole lives working for the country and contributing to the country, and they're finding it difficult also. So it's a wide range of problems.
And you would think like these are questions that many of us don't have to think about, like, do I have to pay my bills or do I eat today? That's a very, very difficult decision. Yeah. And I know you guys have like a sort of no questions asked policy or arrangement. What drove you to create that sort of space?
Well, I'm a kind of a person that likes to know about people and I have to refrain from saying, well, what's your name and where are you from? But it's important that people tell you when they're ready their story. Each person, we don't know what people's stories are. One time this man came into the day centre and Brother Kevin noticed him, and he was dressed in a pinstripe suit and he had a briefcase. So Kevin said, you know, you don't need to be here. What brings you here? Oh, he said, I was a businessman, he said, and my business is after going bankrupt. My marriage is broken up and we lost the family home, so I'm living in my car. So after that, Kevin said, oh, we cannot ask people questions like that. And like, as I walked over here and I was just thinking, this could be any of us. One minute we could be very kind of successful business-wise and I suppose economically very successful, and then that could happen, change in 5 minutes. So I think for me, it's about being grateful for what I have and trying, if I can, to share what I have with other people. And I think that's the Christian calling. And most religions, that's the calling. We have to share our resources with each other.
And like you said, that sort of when you see certain people or when you see certain a man in a suit with a nice briefcase and things like that, we make assumptions about people's lives and we never know what's kind of going on deeply, the emotional baggage and things that people have to hold and make really difficult decisions.
So I'll give you a good example. I was years ago, I was going out to Raheny in the bus, and do you know these Mohegan hairstyles?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, this man was sitting in front of me, and I said, oh, and I looked, and we passed St. Bridget's Church, I think it's out there in Clontarf, and he blessed himself. I says, oh, we cannot judge people by their externals. We don't know what's going on in their heart. So this is what we try to do in the day centre, to open our hearts, not to judge, but to love. Not to judge, but to love, and to open our hands to give. And what fascinates me and what really is wonderful to see is how grateful people are. And you see the lives and the way they live and how they're still standing, how they're looking after their children. Like Sister Stan, I saw an interview recently and she said, oh, what really touches my heart is I see mothers looking after their children and they're looking after them so well with so little.
And it's so profound how much that little act of care, providing a meal, creating a safe space can transform, especially when people are going through such hardship, can transform how they may see themselves and how they can ultimately give back to society. And can you tell us a bit more about, because I know that the centre offers more than just the meals. Tell us what services that you offer.
We say it's about feeding the poor, but there's a group of retired men, real Dubliners, that they come in every morning for breakfast. And they're not homeless, but one of them said to me, I love coming here because there's a great sense of community. And he said, I don't see anyone from one end of the day to the next. And he said, I just feel so lonely. And there is the poverty of loneliness that, this is a real problem in our country, that people, and especially the elderly, are just left there sometimes. So these men come in and have great banter. The Dublin sense of humour is just a wonderful sense of humour. There's all that. But he said, one thing I love about coming here is that if I'm not here, I know that I'll be missed.
Mm.
I know, like, I might say, oh, where's John today? Or where's Martin? Or whoever it might be. The other thing is that like we serve 1,000 hot meals a day. That's breakfast that starting at 7 o'clock in the morning and finishes at 11:30. And also then we close from 11:30 to 12:30. Then we serve dinner at 12:30. And this is a full soup, main course and dessert and tea and coffee. So it's a good high quality service. We also provide 130 infant parcels each Monday. And that contains essentials for baby like formula food and nappies. Every Wednesday, we give out over 1,400 food parcels. And these contain basics like tea bags and bread and butter and tin food. And then also there's the health service clinics around throughout the week. And we have a full-time nursing manager there. And it reaches out to the health needs of our guests, like GP, nursing, dentistry, chiropractic, and opticians. So it's like a beehive with all these different things happening. And one thing that we have is that during the pandemic, what was built on, some contractor built on free, I may add, to the centre, a family area. So parents can bring their children in to a separate part of the dining hall and have that comfort. And we have cartoons on the wall and things that, like, to make it as welcoming and as nurturing, especially for children and families, as possible.
And that's incredible. And specifically having the space for children just to be free, because a lot of time children don't know what's going on in certain situations and in certain circumstances. And they can just see the hardship. So a space that they can actually just kind of like let loose, be free and feel safe and seen is beautiful. And I suppose, like you said earlier, the work that you're doing, it's not just a meal, it's a community, it's a sense of safety. And I would love to hear, like, how does that, let's say, core as a meal, transform that sense of community for these individuals? How do you believe this work in the centre creates that community for people?
Well, basically because it's so busy and people come in. Like just before Christmas, we had a company, a hotel in Dublin, and they provided breakfast for our guests, and they came in, took over the kitchen and put a full Irish breakfast. And I was sitting down and I had breakfast with one or two of the homeless men. And he said, you know, it's years and years since I sat down with somebody at a table having my breakfast. It's just, and then the conversation starts. And like, people are watching me as a friar. And like, there's a few of the friars involved in the day centre. But like, you know, as with every relationship, You talk about the weather first and then you talk about something else. And then you eventually move into something which you build up that trust. That takes time.
And it really takes a lot of time, patience and understanding.
Especially people who have been hurt. And there's an awful lot of people who have been hurt.
And it's important to take that time to build the trust. Because sometimes there's just in my own work as well with these services, it's like there's expectation that like, oh yeah, it gets done in 2 months. And it's like, no, it takes a lot of time, conversation, trust building for people to first connect with you, build that community, and then get the further supports to come out of, whether it's homelessness, whether it's mental health supports, whether it's child safety and things like that. There's a huge level of psychological work that needs to be done. And it's really great to see that the centre is doing not just vital service in terms of providing meals, providing healthcare, providing all these kind of things, but building that psychological safety, that safety net for people to move forward.
And we actually don't know how we touch people's heart, either positively or negatively. And I just tell you a story. I was buying a clock on Facebook, you know, the marketplace on Facebook. I love cuckoo clocks, but this person had a cuckoo clock for sale. And I went to buy it and she said to me, are you a priest? And I said, I am. And she said, well, you know, anyway, she wouldn't take any money for the clock. So I text her and to thank her. And she texted me back. She said, you know, in the 80s, my husband left us homeless. And she said, I went into Brother Kevin in the day centre and he saved my life and my children's life. And we never forgot that. And she said, you know, God sent you to me because this is my way of saying thank you. This is in the 80s. Now, Brother Kevin probably didn't remember a thing about her, but this is how he touched and changed her life. And if we can do that for one person, it's actually worthwhile.
And just as we close, Father, what is one thing you would love the listeners to hear in terms of understanding how we can create that space of dignity, trust, respect, especially for those who are experiencing homelessness?
I think it's to to educate your children. Like, we have lots of volunteers, and we actually couldn't keep the centre open if it wasn't for our volunteers. But I always encourage parents to encourage their children, especially transition year students, to be part and to come in and do their placement in the day centre if they can. And it's about awareness of that, because there is the homelessness and it's right across the board. And sometimes we're not aware of it. But also to teach each other. And like, I come from a large family of 11 children, but like to teach and to appreciate what we have. Like, I got out of bed this morning. I didn't have to worry about turning on the shower because I was there and the roof was over my head and whatever. And most of us are like that, but there's people who are sleeping in the Phoenix Park last night. So it's about appreciating what we have and giving thanks for what we have, but also allowing ourselves and being grateful in that gratefulness to share what we have with each other.
And that's a fantastic way to close the conversation, having that sense of gratitude for what we have, and extending our hand forward when we have the ability to do so. So thank you so much, Father. Again, folks, that's Father Kevin Kiernan from the Capuchin Day Centre joining me there. That brings us to the end of today's show on Unified, again, supported by Commission Man. Find us on podcast on the Go Loud app or share your thoughts on Unified at newstalk.com. That's Unified with a Y-O-U. Thanks to Marisa O'Sullivan for producing and Aisha Nievi on research. Join us again next week for more on Unified, Sundays at 8 p.m. on News Talk. See you then.